It's My Mac Magazine Podcast 198, Bill Dudney, Sam Levin, Tim Robertson and David Cohen, keeping your nose clean and keeping your Mac clean.
The next generation of radio, it's the MyMac.com Podcast.
And welcome to another edition of the My Mac Magazine Podcast. This is show 198. We're almost at our 200th episode. For our 100th episode, we actually went and did it at the Apple Store, but we're not going to do that this time around. It's going to be a little bit more low-key, but, you know, still 200 episodes is kind of a it's kind of a big thing for us. David Cohen, you're joining us today from the UK. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Pretty good. When was your first show? Going way back to Fenestration segments.
Oh, do you remember? I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, it was a while back. I mean, it's got to be at least 18 months, I'd have thought.
Yeah, it's. I know you weren't here for the 100th show.
No, it was after then. But it's been a long while. And actually, I was talking to somebody about MyMac today and how long I've been associated with the site from a writing side. And you know, it's. It's a good 3 years now. It's a long time.
It is. We're also joined at the beginning of the show this week by our good friend, Bill Dundee. Hello, Bill.
How you doing, Tim?
Good. Gala Factory Software. You make awesome iPhone applications. You're kind of our official MyMac podcast iPhone developer mascot.
Cool.
Have you ever been a mascot before?
I have never. But, you know, geeks, I guess, make good mascots.
That's right. We have to get you a costume. It'll be like a big foam iPhone thing. But on the front of it, we're not going to put the standard, you know, iPhone buttons or whatever you want to call them. We're going to put really colorful bead-looking things that kind of represent your new program, Codebreaker.
Perfect.
What is Codebreaker? What is this? This looks pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's basically a puzzle game. It's a lot like if you've ever played... Mastermind,
yep.
From Milton Bradley. They have another game that's very similar kind of thing. So in Codebreaker, the computer comes up with a 4-bead code, and your job is to guess it, and you get 10 guesses to try to do that, and if you make it, you win, and if you don't, you lose.
And you have to get the colors in order.
Exactly. The colors have to be in the right order, and, you know, the right color in the right slot. And there's 6 colors to choose from, so it's... Yeah, it's challenging for kids.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's. I don't see how you could even have a strategy, really. I mean...
Yeah, well, your first guess is, or your first shot is always a guess, and then what happens is the computer tells you with red and white dots whether or not you got beads in the right spot, or if you got the right color but the wrong spot. And
awesome.
So... Yeah, so when you get to 4 red beads or 4 red dots, that's when you know you've won. When you have white ones, it means you have the right color of bead, but it's sitting in the wrong slot. And if you have one red dot or 2 red dots, whatever, that means you have the right color in the right slot. And so then it's sort of just a logic puzzle. You drag them out, you take your first guess, and then you get one right, and you try to figure out which one that is, and then you build on that.
And you get 10 chances.
Yep, exactly.
So this is a $499 game?
Yeah, actually, we're going to put it on sale this week for $2, and then, you know, so go out and run and buy it now.
$2, and what's it going to be after this week?
Actually, it's not this week. It's going to go up when we do the next release, which will probably be about a month. I have a vacation coming up, so I won't get a lot done in the next couple weeks, but when we do the next release, we're going to put some new features in it and stuff, and the price is going to go up.
So right now is the time to buy it, definitely.
Exactly.
Now, does the Apple Store allow you to offer discounts to pre-existing customers, or is that something that's not really built into the App Store yet?
Well, what's cool is that you will actually get the update for free. So if the price goes up, you know, we're thinking about going up to either $299 or $499, depending on how many of the features we have planned put into it. But if you buy it now, when that update comes out, you'll get the update for nothing.
So you'll get the better version, more advanced, harder. So after you've mastered this version, and it'll only cost you $2, infinite play when the new version comes out.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Exactly.
Looks really cool. Been a lot of iPhone news this last week. The big one, Tabap. Blah. How do you say that? Tabulous. I don't know. I can't say it. they lost one of their. I guess they fired their main software developer. It's kind of a crazy story, and it's kind of the first iPhone app developer out there that's making big news on this front. I mean, up till now, you know, it's such a new industry that you haven't really heard anything about it. But Mike Lee ousted from Tabulous.
Yeah,
I just can't say that.
Yeah. I mean, that whole thing, you know, it's really hard to tell, and you only get one side of the story, and he's a brilliant guy, and they're sort of silly for losing him. But, you know, whatever. He's going to do something really cool. And
I think they'll both be fine, don't you?
I think so. I mean, you know, good iPhone developers are hard to come by, so they're really foolish, I think. You know, just in general, letting anyone go that's really good is never a good idea. But you never know what the deal is with personality types or whatever, right? There could be somebody there that where he and the people who own the company just rub each other the wrong way. So, you know, maybe it's best for both of them if they just split company.
You know,
the story sort of said that apparently they had a difference of opinion over the sort of applications they wanted to develop. And I guess, you know, if you're dealing with something which is, you know, is 90% hard work but 10% you know, creative inspiration, and the creative thing is what drives everything else. It must be difficult if you have people who have opposing views. So I guess, you know, probably in the long term, it's good that he's moving on and he will be able to do what he wants to do. But I guess the problem is what happens in the meantime, because they're getting quite a lot of bad press over it.
Yeah, which is a real bummer for them. Because I think, like Tim was saying, I think chances are really good that us as iPhone users are going to get more cool apps, because what he wants to build is now going to get built, because he's going to run off and build it. And whatever the Tabulous people wanted to build is going to get built. So now we'll have two sort of talented pools of people going forward building cool stuff. So,
yeah.
It's a shame.
When the iPhone 2.0 software announcement happened, and Steve Jobs came out and introduced the App Store for the first time, he also introduced a $100 million fund for iPhone developers. From everything that I've been reading online over the last week or two, it seems to be another big story that's out there. There's a lot of VC capitalists out there that's starting to throw money around at iPhone developers. Any big chunks of change trying to land in your pocket yet, Bill? And do you expect any to?
Yeah, well, you know, I think even if I had someone come knock on my door, I'd tell them no. I've been in the industry for a long time doing all sorts of stuff, and I've been through four different startups. And one of them was VC-backed, and then the other one, other three were all angel-funded. And I am pretty keen on just doing my own thing, and I don't want to be a millionaire. I don't want to take over the world. I don't want to conquer the planet. I want to build something cool that is my own and that no one can fire me from, or that I don't have to put up with some boneheaded VC or CEO guy heading the wrong direction.
So if Pepsi came up to you and offered you $150 million to write them an app that basically shows you tap at a Pepsi bottle, fills up with pop, and then you could pour it out and shake it around.
Oh, I'd be all over that.
Yeah. just wanted to verify, because for that much money, I'll learn programming, okay, Bill?
Yes, I hear you, man. I hear you. Yeah, I actually have been doing quite a bit of consulting work, too, which has been really fun. So I've been able to build a bunch of, a whole bunch of different things for a bunch of different people doing really interesting stuff that is, you know, that sort of gets my fix in for the bigger stuff, which is cool.
I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. Bill, what do you think about the general level of quality of stuff you're seeing in the App Store at the moment? Because one of the things that I'm concerned about when I hear these stories of VC funding, and certainly there's been some commentary about the business approach some of the VCs are taking, which is, you know, never mind building quality. We just want to see large numbers of product. We want to throw plenty of apps out there and see which ones stick and start bringing the returns back. I'm a bit concerned that we run the risk of seeing something like we saw in the early days of the Sony PlayStation, when, you know, everyone moved into the market in a big way because they smelled a buck, and there was an awful lot of still mediocre quality stuff, and it was very difficult to pick out the gems. I mean, how do you feel that's going? Do you think the quality level is still there?
Well, there is starting to be that filtering up, you know, on the App Store. When you go look, there's enough reviews now, even though some of them are boneheaded and, you know, whatever, but there's enough reviews now, I think, coming in that we can tell what's good, or at least we can tell what's really bad, what we want to avoid. But it really does, it concerns me with all of the money that's entering the iPhone market specifically, but just the Mac space in general. There tends to be, whenever a lot of money enters, that huge amount of money is chasing a limited number of resources. And so people will go pick up a, you know, how to teach yourself Mac programming in 21 days or iPhone programming in 21 days. And they'll spend 2 weeks going through that book and call themselves an iPhone expert and build really bad software. And
I
think
there goes my plans.
But I think in general, we run the risk of having this huge influx of people and have the overall quality of the space go down because of that number. And my hope is that the culture is strong enough that the people who are entering that space that can make it, that are, you know, that have the right Mac feel about them or whatever.
Right.
Those people, I think, will stick around, and over time, I'm hopeful, and I feel like especially the user culture is really big on quality. They want usability. It isn't about, you know, what's the dirt cheapest application I can get that fulfills this tiny need of mine. It's, I want something that's beautiful, that has, you know, great graphics in it, has a really good user experience. And I think that that culture will survive. So, you know, for the next amount of time, X whatever that time frame is, we'll have a lot of churn and a lot of silly stuff and a lot of flashlight applications and whatever. But then over time, I think that the culture will push back on that, and we'll see, you know, a return to sort of the quality base.
Do you think the reviews on the App Store for programs is fair? Because I see a lot of reviews that the person obviously didn't download the software, but it's just these... this program should only be $1.99.
Oh, yeah.
This is stupid. If you like this, go download this other program because it's free.
Yeah.
In fact, I saw that on one of your programs, and I thought, well, you know what? Maybe this one's better than that free version. Have you ever thought about that? Have you downloaded the... I am of the opinion that the App Store should have some kind of a control mechanism built in that says, you're trying to write a review for this software, and we know that you haven't downloaded or bought it, we're going to disallow a review of it. Do you think that would be fair?
I think so. The problem is complicated. It's a real pain in the neck to try to figure out what's the fairest way to take care of that. And, you know, I haven't talked to a user that's been specifically influenced by the angry 17-year-old posting "this is stupid" on the App Store. You know, I think to a certain degree that has a little bit of influence, but honestly, I mean, when you read a review that says this is the dumbest thing I've ever looked at or whatever, it that's just an obnoxious, idiotic thing.
But the problem is, you know, there's 400 reviews, and you really have to start just kind of skimming through the reviews to find a good one. And by the point that I've gone through 50 reviews, and it's all these just kind of flame bait, I just stop reading the reviews at that point. I mean, it's almost overkill.
Yeah, it really – some of the things that I've seen happen in other sites is that they give the owner of the content an opportunity to respond, if you will. And I don't know how that would work on the App Store, but that might be something to do too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think as well, I mean, it's up to the community, you know, the blogosphere particularly to, you know,
police ourselves.
Yes, start putting together sites where you can go and you know, read you know, reviews from people who have actually used the software and you know, can rate it on a... I mean, all of these things come down to value. If an app is $4.99, $5.99, then you just want a little bit... I mean, it's not a huge amount of money in most cases, but you just want a bit of reassurance that, you know, that it is it does have some extra value over the free application.
Well, you know, you can go up to a lot of the Mac download sites like Mac Update or Version Tracker, and you'll see a lot of quasi-reviews. But at the same time, when a MyMac.com posts a review, that's going to give it a lot more weight than just, you know, some
absolutely.
Guy that... Yeah. So that's going to happen eventually.
Yeah, it just needs a bit of editorial oversight to make sure that, you know, the sort of reviews that people want to read are the ones that have actually been written objectively and fairly and aren't just on the basis of, you know, somebody deciding to show how great they are by having a flame war with someone.
Yeah, let me say that, yes, I'm the owner of AtMinute and MyMac.com. And we do a lot of reviews, and I deal with a lot of developers out there, a lot of PR companies, but at least in the app space, there is no PR companies for the app developers yet. It just hasn't matured to that point, and I kind of hope it doesn't, to be honest. It's always nicer to talk directly to the developers. And so I kind of get, what's the word I'm looking for, kind of advanced looks at a lot of programs for the App Store. And I'm kind of glad that we have Bill occasionally on the show, like we do, because he's one of the better developers out there.
And, thanks, Tim.
You know, I can honestly, and not just because you're on the show right now and I'm going to trash you later, that goes without saying. but I can honestly say, you know, Gala Factory Software up on the app store is just really good stuff. And anybody that's buying your stuff could be rest assured that, you know, they're getting their money worth. And this game, Codebreaker, it's $2, and it's... you know, hours of entertainment. So go check it out.
Cool. Thanks, Tim.
Well, thanks for coming on the show this week, Bill. We have to take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Thanks.
Thank you.
And we're back with Sam Levin, and it's time for Cool Mac Picks. Hello, Sam Levin.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Pretty good. So I understand you're going to be a party animal tonight.
Party, yeah. Actually, I have got it's a rock and roll party. It's a themed party, and basically you dress as any rock person. It does not matter. That means you could be Elvis because he was the beginning. He started. Isn't he called King of Rock?
I think so. Yeah.
He's
the king. I don't know if I would say King of Rock.
Okay, but he really started the whole that rock movement. Even though today it's quite a bit different, but anyway, so tonight you dress as any kind of a rock person, does not matter. It could be classic rock, it could be AC/DC, it doesn't matter. So the whole idea is that I've got two iPods plugged into a JBL Eon speaker system that's got a beautiful mixing board, and one is a classic iPod, one's an iPod Touch, and the iPod Touch is encased in an OtterBox waterproof case. It's awesome. I'm going to shoot some video so you guys could see what this is like. And I know that doesn't sound that cool, but the idea here is that that case will protect it. It's completely waterproof. So you could take it underwater, actually, and use the iPod. OtterBox makes a whole line of waterproof cases for the iPod Touch, iPhone, classic iPod, even the Nano, the Mini, anyway, so I'm excited about it because the whole thing is plugged in to the sound system, and it's like your own DJ system powered by two iPods.
And you said you're going to do a video of it?
I'm going to do a video of it to show how simple it is to mix. You know, you just plug them both in using a mini out jack. And actually, one of them I've got a Keyspan Tune View connected to so that I could walk around and select any tune I want. So one of them is connected to a TuneView dock. The other one is directly connected from a line out, you know, a mini to two RCA cables. Those RCA cables are plugged into the mixing board, and it's done.
Awesome.
It's pretty cool. So you'll see it in the next, possibly next week, I'll show you. It's just a small little video clip of me rocking out with my iPod Touch and my JBL Eon sound system.
And we can post that up at MyMac.com?
We can post it up anywhere. And we're going to post it on AppMinute as well because it's iPhone, iPod Touch related. So
cool.
We'll do both.
All right,
I think,
man,
it will be cool.
What's your picks this week?
God, what is my pick? God.
You said something about a backpack that was solar-powered.
Oh, yeah. There is a cool company called Voltaic Systems. They make solar backpacks for USB devices, portable devices like your cell phone, your iPod, your iPhone. It will power your iPhone and also will power small portable USB devices, probably a PSP, though I don't own one, so I don't know, but I suspect it will.
Probably.
Now, what's cool about Voltaic is they have these are the same solar cells that people are using on their houses, right? So this is heavy-duty stuff, but they embed them on the top of the backpack. They also have a messenger bag version. So if you go to voltaicsystems.com, you'll see what I'm talking about. And you basically power the backpack solar panels in the sun. You can also plug it into an AC or to your cigarette lighter. So they provide those connectors. And once it's charged, you can then power any of your devices. So it will retain the charge. It will hold that charge. And that's a big deal, guys, because if you're traveling, your iPhone will drain battery like crazy. And this will give it, you know, an extra, I don't know, 3 hours.
Yeah.
So that to me, and plus it has an area inside for your laptop. So I can carry my MacBook Pro, 15-inch MacBook Pro, as well as all these other devices. It's got compartments. It's a very cool product. It's called Voltaic Solar Bags by Voltaic Systems. And they start at $199 and go up to $249.
That's not too bad, though.
Well, there's nothing like it on the market. There really isn't. Now, RadTech sells the product as well. You can go to radtech.us and see RadTech's a distributor of theirs. And they come in a few different styles as far as lining. You can get silver, orange, or green lining that surrounds the solar charges. And so it's like a trim. But I am sold on it, especially if you're traveling. And here in California, it's really bright a lot of the time. So, and it will power indoors. So it'll power off of light that's not just sun.
So, oh, cool. Oh, that's cool.
So that is one of my cool picks for today. I think it's a big cool pick. Did we talk about the guys from iDrum last week? I think we did, didn't we?
I can't remember, to be honest. At the time, I remember the application was not working for me, but it is now.
iDrum?
Yep.
Well, iZotope, I-Z-O-T-O-P-E. This will be a cool app pick as well because it's all about iPhone applications. iZotope, that's I-Z-O-T-O-P-E, iZotope.com, makes a really cool line of products called iDrum. It's a virtual drum machine. They also make it on the Mac, by the way, for your iPhone. And what's really cool about this thing is that you can start creating your own riffs. And on the fly, they give you several of them that are pre-made, but you can start creating your own. You could change the ones that they give you. They give you a hip-hop and a club. There's two different versions, a hip-hop or a club edition. It's $4.99 for the iPhone app. And I got to tell you guys, it's probably one of the most fun $5 that you're going to spend in a long time. It works on iPod Touch, iPhone, and iPhone 3G.
Awesome.
And now here's the kicker. After you're done creating your drum beat, whatever it is, you can then click on a button and it saves it as an iPhone ringtone.
Wow.
That's the real kicker. You have to export it out. There's a Mac and PC client. It's free. You send it to that client and then you save it to your iTunes because, as you know, you can't just download a ringtone to your iPhone from thin air.
Right.
That's just part of the API that won't allow you today, but I suspect that will change. But that's called iDrum, and I got to tell you, it's hilarious. I plugged it into these speakers, and I was like a walking, rave machine. It was pretty funny. So those are my two big cool Mac and cool app picks for today. I'll send you the link so that everyone can check it out.
And it will be in show 198. We're almost at our 200th show, Sam, so we got to think of something special to do.
well, we're going to give away a bunch of apps. We still have, you know, we still have two PosiMotion $10 certificates to give away, iTunes certificates. So
do you want to do that this week? Let's do that this week.
Yeah, let's do it. Go ahead.
All you have to do is send an email to news@appminute.com on or before, what's next Wednesday? I'm not even sure of the date next. Next Wednesday would be August 3rd. So on or before August 3rd, I'm sorry, September 3rd, news@appminute.com. We will randomly select two winners for two $10 iTunes gift certificate courtesy of PosiMotion.
PosiMotion, and in our 200th episode, we're going to give away something.
$1 million. No.
No, but we're going to give away, I think, some hardware. We're going to give, I'm not going to say what it is, but it's hardware. It's digital toys, and anyone could use it so that you don't have to have an iPhone or an iPod. But we'll give away some iPod goodies from Spec, like their cases. We'll give away some other goodies, but we'll make it a surprise. iPhone applications, that's part of it. As you all know, I did an interview with Mike Lee, so head to App Minute and listen to that. He just left Tapulous. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's a another story there.
Yeah, it's another story. Even though the interview, it's not about Tapulous. It's about what he wants to do. And just go and listen to it. I won't spend time talking about it today, but I can't wait for the 200th show. I want to give away a lot of toys.
Sounds good. Well, we'll see you next week, Sam.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Have a great day.
You too. And we're back, and it's just David Cohen and myself. We're all alone, David.
Yeah, so I can hear an echo every time I speak.
Yeah, just the two of us. Hopefully next week, what was supposed to happen this week, I was supposed to do an interview with a musician this week, Brian Welch. He used to be the lead guitarist of Korn, but it got messed up a little bit. No biggie. I actually talked to him on the phone today, which is kind of strange. I'm in the grocery store, and I'm talking to the ex-guitarist of Korn. That was kind of surreal. I'm like, oh, that's kind of weird. But I've got to go ahead.
Did they have Korn playing on the Muzak?
No, and I wasn't over in the produce section where they actually keep Korn. So. But still, it was kind of weird. The neat thing was, though, that I had just been listening to his CD in the car when I was going to the grocery store because I got an advanced copy a few weeks ago. And to be quite honest, I haven't listened to it up until today. I've just been extremely busy. I just came off a video project that I did in Utah, which you know all about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I didn't really get a chance to listen to it, and I thought, wow, you know, I'm going to interview this guy today. I probably should start listening to the CD. So I was listening to that in the car. Then I'm in the grocery store, and the guy I was just listening to in the car is on the phone now. It was kind of weird. But he's a Mac user. He has an iPhone, and having an iPhone is probably not that big a deal anymore to musicians. I got to imagine the stars that we all look up to and wish we were. Cough, cough. they're all iPhone users at this point, aren't they?
I would have thought a lot of them are. I mean, it is the hot device, so I would imagine people are getting into it. But obviously, using Macs to make music, that's a very different kettle of fish.
I don't know. More and more people are relying on the Macintosh to record music on, or at least to assemble it.
Yeah, so. I mean, it is a fantastic platform, and still much easier to do it on there than on a PC.
Right. They use Pro Tools and stuff like that. I mean, Pro Tools is pretty much the dominant software in the industry now. So, anyways, let's talk about a little bit about Macintosh stuff, David.
Cool.
A lot of you see, Steve Jobs had an obituary.
He did. That was a bit of a... I mean, you always hear rumors that these news sites have these canned obituaries ready to roll out when somebody, when the occasion demands it. But, Bloomberg accidentally published theirs and still with all the gaps in, saying that, he was X-aged and he died of X and you know, a long, quite a long piece, sort of with a potted history of his life and you know, his goings on within the computer industry and Pixar and that sort of thing. They pulled it pretty quickly, but it was still pretty embarrassing, really.
How weird would that be to read your own obituary? Do you think Steve Jobs got a chance to read it? I mean, he would want to, don't you think?
I'm sure. I would imagine he's very much heard about it, and I don't know what. I mean, obviously, he's a pretty hard-headed guy. But I don't know whether I don't know enough about him to know whether he would deliberately go out of his way to try and track it down and see what they said.
Would you?
I don't think so.
You don't think you would go read your own obituary?
No, because I suspect I'd probably be profoundly disappointed.
Yeah, I think I would have like three lines, and you know, donations can be sent to the McIntosh Widows Fund or something.
I mean, that you can't control what people's perception of you is. So I guess all you can do really is try and do the best you can in everything you do, and then hope that people appreciate it after you've gone. At least, I mean, I take the view that, you know, really your friends and family, it's how they view that's really important. How the public at large view you and your activities is nice if you can get recognition, and if you can't, well, you know, most of us can't. Most of us are not remembered when we're gone.
That's
apart
true.
From our friends and family.
So a little bit of negative about Apple. They're still hearing a lot of rumblings about iPhone 3G performance as well as Mobile Me. I mean, it's been, what, over a month now since both of those services started up, and it's still bad.
Absolutely, and you know, they really can't catch a break at the moment. I think they took some justified criticism for some of the things that went wrong, but it's interesting that some of the negative press now is certainly coming across to me as negative press for negative press's sake. I mean, there's all that business about the iPhone 3G having poor signal strength and maybe having a faulty chip. And those have now been independently tested and have been shown to be perfectly okay. And in fact, it's a carrier problem.
But you know, it looks, Steve Jobs actually came out and said that a lot of this will be fixed in a firmware update. So, I mean, Steve Jobs himself kind of let a lot of this speculation run wild and responded to it.
But it turns out that the fix that Apple's already done, and then further fixes they'll do, are about supporting the carrier network to carry more calls rather than necessarily a problem the phone themselves. Apparently, it's a nature of 3G that it can get saturated if the signal strength adjustments in the phones aren't quite right. So they've been adjusting that to try and help AT&T out. So
are you trying to say that the phone companies are a little lazy, David?
I can't believe it. I wouldn't say lazy. It's more a question of competence, I think.
I think I'd rather be called lazy than incompetent. That's just me, though. You know that Tim, he's lazy, yeah. You know that Tim, he's incompetent. Well, no, I think I would like to be considered lazy. That would fit me a little better.
I think the problem with this negative press, though, is it does kind of build a momentum of its own. I mean, we had a situation here this week in the UK where our Advertising Standards Authority, which is the organisation that polices the advertising codes here in the UK, had a finding against Apple for one of their iPhone ads.
For their truthfulness in ads.
Exactly, and really, having I mean, I went when the story hit, I went and actually read the adjudication online, and I was actually pretty disappointed with what had gone on here. Effectively, I mean, it was one of the iPhone ads, you know, where the guy's holding the phone in his hand and he's doing stuff with it, and you know, the voiceover is describing what they're doing, and the voiceover in this particular ad was saying, you know, you might want to check for a holiday and check for a hotel and all of this sort of thing. And so because of that, you want the whole internet. And he uses the words, so we provide you the whole internet on your phone. And the Advertising Standards Authority received two complaints about that advert, saying that the iPhone doesn't support Flash or Java. And so therefore,
Which is true.
And so, but they said that therefore it's not the whole internet. And Apple
said, which kind of is kind of true, though. I mean, that, do you not think that's a valid point?
No, I don't, because in my view, you can go to any website on the iPhone, and you know, some sites might not have the same experience because they rely very heavily on Flash. But let's face it, you can go to, I mean, as Guy was talking about a couple of weeks ago, you can go to Mobile B on Internet Explorer and it doesn't work. Now, does that mean that the Internet Explorer does not give you the whole internet? No, it just means it has. It means it. There are features on some websites that it doesn't support.
But at this point in time, don't you think though that Flash really is a web standard at this point? Even though it's owned by Adobe, I mean, Flash is kind of the dominant video service for the internet at this point.
The point I think that Apple was trying to make was that they, using the iPhone compared to other smartphones on the market, you can go to any website and you will see something. If the website doesn't work properly, then you know that might be a particular problem. But what they were saying was there was no walled garden like you get with other carrier phones, where you can only go to WAP sites or certainly formatted sites that deal specifically with the engines on those phones. You can go anywhere you want because it's a standard web browser. Yeah. Now there are things it doesn't implement, but Apple's argument was that we don't prevent you from going anywhere. It's just that the experience will vary depending on what the website provides. Now, the Advertising Standards Authority felt that the complainants had a valid point and therefore has asked them to withdraw the ad and to not basically it's told them they can't run it again without modifying it because they feel it's slightly misleading. But I felt that was pretty harsh, to be honest. This particularly had... you know, thousands of people complained about this ad that they got the iPhone and been disappointed with the web browsing experience. And it was completely different from the ad. That would be a different matter. But this was two people, and
I don't know. I think it's kind of cool that two people could really make a difference. They could really say, "Hey, that's technically not really true," and your government said, "You know what? These two people are absolutely correct."
Well, that's
I kind of think that's kind of cool.
that's the way things are done over here. I mean, we don't have the...
No, it's like that, too, here. I mean, we used to have the, and I'm sure it's still like up there, Christian Coalition something, and it sounded very official, but it turned out it was one guy, and he would watch television and start up, you know, oh, we're going to not watch your show if you run these ads from this company, and... The sponsors took it very seriously, and it turned out to be one guy.
Yeah.
And even though everyone knew it was one guy after a while, it didn't make any difference because just simply the name of his organization, and it was getting news on CNN and Fox and all those other things, the Christian Coalition Against False Advertising or whatever the heck it was, it was still one guy, and he was actually making a difference. So in that kind of case, I'm like, ugh, what a jerk.
Yeah. Well, maybe this is a Nokia coalition against Apple iPhone.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
So I mean, the real question, I guess, is, you know, obviously it's easy for the media to kick Apple when they detect maybe they're slightly down. The question is, should Apple care, or does Apple care, and should we care?
Well, yeah, I care because I follow this industry, and I've been doing so since 1995 professionally. So, yeah, I care, and it's food for this podcast.
Yeah.
By the same token, does Apple care? Well, yeah, because there is a perception out there that Apple products are cool, that their advertising is fresh and new, and, you know. So, and I think in some respects, Apple does care. Do they care at the higher levels of the company? Probably not. But I think that the people who work in advertising sales and that sort of thing at Apple, absolutely, they do care. Because this is their job.
Yeah, I guess so. I think the thing to remember is you know, perception is everything. I just wonder whether the media perception that's being portrayed of Apple as a company that maybe is struggling a little bit in terms of, you know, some of the difficulties they're having at the moment, whether those are actually borne out in terms of sales. I mean, they're continuing to apparently sell very well, both on the iPhone and the Mac side.
Well, you so know, maybe, the iPhone G3 now has sold more than the original iPhone.
Exactly. So, you know, it doesn't. These negative stories don't seem to be slowing the sales down. I guess ultimately that's what it all comes down to. So maybe this is a situation much like people have said about Microsoft and Vista. They're saying even though Vista is constantly being criticized as being not a very good operating system, in fact it's still selling extremely well, and there are still PCs being shipped with it. So maybe this is a similar situation that despite negative stories about Apple in the press, people are still interested in buying the products in vast numbers.
Well, the sales seems to reflect that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
The little company that we thought would go away after the big bad Apple legal team sued them just countersued, David.
Absolutely. I suppose this is a good example of what happened to a really crackerjack lawyer.
Yeah, SciStar has countersued Apple, saying it's anti-competitive for them, for them being Apple, not to allow their software, their operating system, run on third-party hardware.
I listen to that argument, I think, are these guys on crack? You know, how can it be anti-competitive if you've got a system that, you know, you sell hardware and software? Why should you have to open it out to everybody if you're not the dominant player in the market, which Apple are not, because they only have less than 10% market share.
Should a car company start up and buy cars from GM, rip the motors out, put them in their own cars, and sell those cars? Should that be legal?
I don't know, to be honest.
I don't know either. I think that's kind of the same type of argument. You're taking something that runs a car, an engine, and you're putting it in another car. Now, obviously, the aftermarket could do that all they want as long as they don't sell it. But this is a company that's selling computers, and they're advertising them as Macintosh computers, selling, you know, running Apple hard or software on their own hardware. I don't know where the legal precedence is going to fall on that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether it actually comes to court or whether this is actually just a strategy. I mean, you know, this legal team that SciStar have hired are clearly very good, because they've looked at the entire thing and they found what they believe to be at least the potential for a legal argument.
And this was a lot of pundits' thoughts that Apple would be the most afraid of, which is why they didn't sue them right away.
That's right.
That it would be ruled that, you know, it is anti-competitive for Apple not to allow other companies to run their software on other hardware. So this is kind of Apple's worst fear come to pass.
It could be, and it could be that this is just a strategy to get a decent settlement. Because let's face it, I mean, the people who run SciStar, we know it's a small operation. Do we honestly believe that they went into this with the aspiration of selling millions of computers and making their money that way? Or was actually this their strategy all along, that they wanted to get into a position where they could get a lawsuit in front of Apple and then get a settlement? Because in terms of a settlement will be, you know, here's some money, and in exchange for that money, you go out of business and you go and find something else to do.
But wouldn't that be a dangerous precedent for Apple to follow?
Haven't they done it many times before?
I don't know. Those kind of things usually kind of disappear.
What happened to the wasn't there a rumor site that they settled with in the end, and then they paid him money for him to not do rumor sites anymore?
Well, they basically bought the site from him and closed it down.
So could they not do the same with SciStar?
I think it's a different precedent, though, because this is actual sales. This is not just a website, which is essentially what Apple bought with, what was it called now? I can't even remember the name of it now. Regardless, you know, that's a website that Apple just bought and closed down.
Right. What I find interesting about the countersuit is, just from my initial reading, I did see one, what I thought might be a potential flaw in the countersuit, and that is they claim that they are reselling a fully licensed copy of OS X with the SciStar machine, and they're selling it unmodified.
It's definitely modified.
It's definitely modified on the machine, and I think that's where they may possibly be coming unstuck with this.
Only if they get to court, though.
Well, yeah, but you know, it'd be interesting to see anyway.
Absolutely, I'm very curious on how this is going to resolve itself. Let's take a few minutes to stop our discussion and talk about our sponsor, MacSales.com. David, you got a fairly new computer, the Dead Mac.
The Dead Guy Mac, absolutely.
And you actually named it the Dead Guy Mac.
I have. That's what I've named the hard drive.
find out who owned it?
His name is a chap called Anthony Botley. And I don't think he actually was. He actually's dead. At least I found no evidence that he's dead. But
so he might be alive out there.
Yeah, I mean, the town I bought the machine in Huddersfield has a university as well as, you know, it's a smallish town, but it has a university. And given the extent of music on the machine and the type of music it was, which was mostly like ska punk type stuff, I find it hard to believe that this was a more elderly gentleman's machine, Mr. Botley. So it could have been a student sale as opposed to you know, somebody whose house had been cleared off. They'd sadly passed away. Let's hope so anyway.
Yeah, definitely. How much RAM is in that machine?
Well, it came with the standard 512K that 512 meg that shipped with the iMac G5s.
Yep.
I did crack it open and upgrade it to 2 gig because I was going to put Leopard on there.
How much did you pay for the 2 gigs?
Let's see. I was about $60-$70. Bought it
really
converting it into dollars. I actually bought it off. I bought it from a guy who was selling X server RAM off eBay.
Yeah, that's kind of scary, too.
So it was a bit of a gamble, I've got to be honest. But
if you'd have gone up to MacSales.com, the sponsor of the show that you co-host, for a 2 gigabyte upgrade, you could have spent $44.99.
Yeah, the shipping would have killed me, though.
Yeah, maybe. But if you do have one of those machines, you can also upgrade it to 4 gigs. That's the max amount of RAM you can put on there. Less than $100. It's $95.99.
You know what? I was looking through this page of the iMac upgrades. These are for the Intel Macs. And, you know, they really are. It amazes me how reasonable these prices are. For less than $100, you have the full 4 gig. And the drives they've got on there as well. I mean, for less than $200, you can put terabyte drive in one of these machines.
Amazing. I mean, it turns it into a completely different machine when you have that much space and that much RAM in it.
I mean, obviously having the machine with 512 meg and then taking it up to 2 gig, it was immediately noticeable how much more responsive it was.
Yep.
I mean, it completely transformed it. So certainly Leopard is a big operating system and it needs plenty of memory. And you know, for the price now, I mean, crikey, I can remember spending, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds for sort of like 4 megabytes of memory 10, 12 years ago. So the amount of memory you can get nowadays, it's just not worth, it's not worth not upgrading the memory, to be honest.
I got a 2 megabyte RAM chip for $400 back in 1996.
Yeah.
And that was a pretty good price at the time.
One of my first jobs, I used to work for a utility company here in Manchester, and we had machines in a call centre in the centre of Manchester, and it kept on being broken into. And so they glued all the computers down to the desktop to stop them being stolen. And the thieves thought that was great the next time they came around because that made it easy for them to crowbar the cases off and steal the memory out.
Because yeah, that was an expensive piece.
The police who came to investigate told me, actually, they said, well, on the street, the memory is worth more than heroin. Sort of pound for pound, you know, gram for gram.
I'm not surprised.
They were going and just clearing out all these chips and then reselling them on.
It's not like that today. What is expensive with if you were going to break into someone's house, heaven forbid, and you could take something, you can't take the entire Mac, what do you take? What is super expensive nowadays that you would think, okay, yeah, I'm definitely going to take the RAM or the hard drive or the video card. I can't think of anything that's so expensive in computers anymore that realistically you couldn't replace for just a couple $100.
No, absolutely.
I mean, obviously the data is worth more nowadays.
Yeah, I guess so. This is the thing. The component prices have dropped so low that you know, really it wouldn't be worth breaking a machine apart to try and take anything out of it unless it was something particularly specialized.
Yeah, I mean, if you had like a super video card and a Mac Pro, I could understand that maybe. But I, other than that, there's really nothing super expensive. You can, like you said, you can get a terabyte drive now for, you know, a couple $100.
Absolutely.
And that's just crazy. That is just insane. One of the other things I do like about Mac sales, though, if you go up there and, for instance, select the iMac Pro Core 2 Duo memory upgrades, they don't just have, like, one set of memory that you can buy. They have from 4 different manufacturers.
Yeah.
They have the OWC memory, which is the cheapest as far as price. Well, no, it's not the cheapest in price, but it's comparable. And then they have TechWorks, which is usually the cheapest. And then they have Micron, which is factory original, and Samsung, which is factory original, which is slightly more. They give you four different companies that you can get the RAM from at OWC. I like that. I don't know why I should like that. I don't know why it should make any difference, but I like choice, and OWC is giving us that choice. That's cool.
Well, yeah, and when it comes to memory, I mean, some people like the factory original stuff. They like the fact that it's been really, you know, comprehensively tested against the motherboards and machines and, you know, is guaranteed to work. And other people, you know, they say, well, memory is memory, and I just want, you know, some nice cheap chips and save a few dollars in the process. So, again, you've got the opportunities to whichever particularly floats your boat, you can do.
Well, you know, I look at it like I would be happy to get the OWC memory. I'll give you an example for this machine. 4 gigabyte upgrade kit, which is 2 gig modules matched, because you got to upgrade it in pairs.
Yeah,
would cost $87.99 for the OWC memory. The same Micron is $107.99, and the Samsung is $109.99.
That's right.
But OWC is going to guarantee that it's going to work.
Absolutely, and also same day shipping as well. So you're not going to be waiting for that either, and that's also very important.
Absolutely. So thank you very much to Mac Sales for sponsoring our podcast this week, and they'll be sponsoring it for some time here in the future, which is awesome. Let's jump back to some Mac news. There's a special event coming up in September, David.
Well, that's the rumors.
There always is. I think they've had a special event in September for the last 2 or 3 years.
Well,
it's always iPhone-related so far.
Yes, iPhone or iPod.
Or iPod.
Traditionally been the September event. Now, but what's interesting this year is that in the last earnings call, they mentioned that there was going to be something particularly special coming out in the fall.
And they also said that they're not going to make as much money on it as some of their traditional products.
That's right. So
what do you think? You think it's going to be a replacement of something that we currently have or a brand new product?
Well, for them to make a specific... I mean, traditionally they never talk about future products. So, it seemed to me to make a specific mention about that in the earnings call suggests this is going to be something slightly different than just a simple body refresh of the iPod line. So maybe, you know, they're looking to skew the business model somewhere differently. And if they're not going to make as much money on it, perhaps it's going to be, lower cost hardware, and they're going to look to set up more of a revenue stream. So one idea I had was maybe a cheap Nano, $100 16 gig Nano, but with that you basically buy a contract that commits you to buy stuff from iTunes over 12 months. So it'd be
Columbia House Records, but it's an iPod.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's interesting.
And if you think about it, that's kind of a similar model to the cell phone model they have, you know, where you buy a subsidized phone and then but they claw back on the revenue from the carrier over.
How do you do that with music on the iPhone, though? I mean, do they just charge you for a certain amount of songs regardless? Or
maybe they could do it with kind of like a credit system where effectively you fill your account up every month with $20 worth of iTunes tracks, or alternatively it could be something like an all you can eat subscription model where
that's kind of what I'm waiting for.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is everyone's kind of wondered whether this is the way that Apple might eventually go. The question has always been whether the music industry will let them go that way. So it'll be interesting to see, really. It wouldn't surprise me if they did it slightly differently, because I think that's the way that Apple likes to do it, is tweak the business model in a different direction. And rather than the last thing I'm sure they would want is for people to say, oh, they've just, it's just like Rhapsody or it's just like the Zune Music Store. I'm sure they would want to have a different spin on it than that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'm really looking forward to finding out what's going on.
Yeah.
I try not to play the speculation market too much when it comes to Apple, because I'm almost always wrong, and it usually is better than I was thinking. So I'm looking forward to it. Whatever it is, I'm going to be real happy about.
Absolutely.
Get a quick rundown on what's going on up at mymac.com. Now, like I said earlier, I've been gone. Let's see, I left Sunday and I returned basically Thursday, very, very early Thursday morning. So I've been behind on getting stuff posted. So at the moment, we've got two things from Rich Lefko. We've got a Rage Sitemap Automator review and an iTrip Autopilot, which is an FM transmitter for your iPod or your iPhone. Both of those reviews are up at MyMac.com, and before that is MyMac Podcast 197, The Dead Zone. That came from Guy. Guy Searle decided The Dead Zone would be a cool name for the podcast that week, and that's what we went with. And a bunch of stuff up on the blogs.
Yeah, it's been fairly busy on the blog side, actually.
Yeah, and right now we've got, the last time I looked, these weren't here. Guy Searle has two things posted. Guy, if you can be posting stuff over the blog site, why aren't you on the podcast? Yeah. What's going on, Guy?
Yeah. And I actually did put a comment on one of these. He was talking about his experience with low-cost inkjet printers and how, you know, they'd let him down when he needed one. And I did say that, you know, and I think this
blog post.
Yeah, it is a long blog post, but basically he ended up with two broken inkjet printers and one new one, just so he could print out a single piece of paper for his son. And I think this is a tip worth mentioning here on the podcast. I think people have got to remember, if you only occasionally print something, it's very tempting to buy, you know, a $50 inkjet printer. But that is a throwaway printer. You can't leave it sat on your desk for 6 months.
The ink will dry up.
And then turn it on and be. You should not be surprised if it doesn't work. And you know, if you turn it on the first time in 6 months, you're going to need to print something there and then. I would say to people, and this is something I do myself, is first of all, decide whether you can live without color. Because if you can live without color for not very much money, you can pick up a very cheap personal laser. Yep. And the advantage
I've got two of those.
Yeah, the advantage of a laser is they are ultra reliable. You turn it on and it will work.
Well, usually they cycle when they're shut down. Unless you actually turn it off. If you just once it's printed, they usually go to sleep, but they'll continue to cycle themselves once every couple days. Or I've got a couple, like the Lexmark, what is this, the E332N, which is a network printer, and I've had it for a number of years. I actually reviewed it and kept it, paid Lexmark money because I really liked it. It's still on the original toner cartridge, which is kind of surprising. But probably once every 2 or 3 hours, you hear it recycle itself for just a second. It goes clunk, 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 clunk.
Yeah.
So it's ready.
That's right. And the thing is, you just made the point there. Lasers are much, much cheaper to run than an inkjet printer. I mean,
by the same token, though, those cartridges, when they go bad,
yeah, but they're
expensive.
Yeah, they are expensive, but the point is, if you look at them over the cost of the
they last forever.
You know, they last for a long time. And the thing is, for probably around $250, you can have a color laser. And
I've got one of those too. I've got another Lexmark that's a color printer.
Yeah, and then not so long back, you know, I think people would have thought $250 was a pretty cheap price for a printer.
Oh,
and yet
yeah.
We're so used to the fact that, you know, we can have a $50 printer now, we just don't reflect on the fact that, you know, they're just rubbish and they just won't be reliable for you. And for me, in computing, reliability is all above everything else. If it doesn't work, it's not much good to you.
That being said, if you're going to be printing pictures, you really do want an inkjet printer. Well, most of the color laser jet printers will not take the glossy paper. I've tried it in the past too. Disastrous results. I literally ruined an inkjet or a laser color printer by sending that paper through it.
But you know what? Unless you're going to be doing a lot of photo printing, then if you've got a laser, you can always print to a service and get them sent to you, and they'll often do a much better job than you can do with a $50 inkjet printer.
Oh, absolutely. That being said, though, I've used some. Well, what is that over there? It's an HP. All-in-one that I reviewed a number of years ago. It's still got the original ink. What I do is I'll literally print something maybe once a month just to keep it, you know, fresh.
Yeah.
But when I print on that at the highest quality using inkjet, you know, the glossy paper, man, it really does come out well. I mean, it looks good. And it looks even better if I use the matte photo finish. That's really nice on that. But the matte paper generally costs a little bit more.
Yeah,
and you know, I don't take that good of photography for pictures to justify spending that much money. But here's a bit of trivia. Our 13-year-old Brittany I gave her an older HP digital camera. I had it was like a 5.1 megapixel,
right?
And she started, you know, it's got like 32 megs built in, or it had a 32 meg. What kind of card? What is the SIM card in that?
SD card? Or
SD card, thank you, yes. And she started taking a lot of pictures and then putting them on her MacBook. And I started noticing her pictures are really good. She has a really good eye for picture composition, and she's doing it intuitively. So I started showing her websites and stuff to go to learn more about photography. And she's really starting to get into it. She went and spent $20 and got a 2-gig card for it. So now, even at the highest setting on that phone, she could take, you know, like 1,000 pictures almost. It's amazing.
Wow.
But you know, the thing is, $20 for a 2-gigabyte SD card.
I know.
How are these things dropping in price so fast, David?
Well, it's just volume. I mean, digital cameras is the reason why. You know, that together with MP3 players means that flash memory is just being made in enormous quantities, which means it's very, very cheap. I was having a discussion with somebody online about this the other day. We were talking about the Apple E-Mate, which was a Newton-based word processing machine that they used to make for schools.
There were the green clam book things.
That's right. You know, and I used to have one of these, and they were very, very nice computers, really, really very much ahead of their time. The problem with them was you could never get any data off them because they only had serial ports on. And, you know, it was hard. You could set them up for networking, this sort of thing, but you still had to get drivers and things onto the machine to make all of that work. And if you didn't have a serial cable or a serial port on your Mac, and let's face it, you know, you can't buy Macs with serial ports anymore.
No.
It was really, really hard. And I in the discussion about this, I did say to the person I was talking to, I said, you've got to remember these were designed in the early 90s when the processors and memory we have now couldn't be dreamed of. They cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And we're really spoilt by things like USB, which is very high speed and completely plug and play, and the fact that you can plug in a USB, because they said something like, couldn't you just put a flash card on the side? And I said, no, because it just wouldn't work.
Actually,
not like
there
it does
are
nowadays.
Modifications. I've seen hacks that use SD cards in those machines now.
Right.
But I've seen TRS-80s that's been hacked to use flash cards.
Yeah.
It's all
yeah.
the controller that they've been. And they're not the fastest, don't get me wrong. You're not getting, you know, super fast access time because the pipes in the computer itself just can't handle it.
Exactly.
But it does, it will use all the storage, which is kind of surprising.
Yeah, but, you know, four gigs, 2 gigs for a few dollars, it's just it's something else. In something that's the size of your thumbnail, it's just amazing.
And the size of the pictures really aren't going up drastically as far as physical file sizes. If you get up into, you know, the real expensive cameras and you're taking raw photographs, then it gets a little big.
Well, even
then
I mean
a 4-gig card, but
yeah, I've got a 4-gig card in my Nikon D40 digital SLR, and even in RAW that will take 550 pictures.
And by that point, your battery's going to die. I mean, you know.
Well, exactly. That is actually virtually pretty much one charge worth of battery. And, you know, back in the old film days, you were looking at 36 exposures on a single roll. And
yeah.
you couldn't realistically, even if you were a pro photographer, carry more than about 10 rolls with you.
And then there was a cost of developing, which was more expensive than
exactly.
the film itself.
And in fact, I still have a film SLR that I carry in the car. I take pictures every now and again with, just because it was cheaper than buying another digital one that sets there doing nothing most of the time. And every time I finish a roll of that, I look at how much I have to pay for film processing, and I wince.
It used to be... Go ahead.
Yeah, it's nearly $20 for a 36 exposure roll now.
Yep, it's crazy because no one's doing it.
Yeah.
But it's funny, you know, we used to have these rituals that you'd go drop off the film, and a day or two later you'd go get it, and the first thing you do, you'd get in your car and you'd flip through the photos to see what they look like.
That's right.
Nowadays, you take a picture, and then you turn the picture around so everyone else can see it. You hold it down to chest level, and you kind of angle it so the other people could see the picture you just took.
Yeah.
Everybody does that with a digital camera. It's kind of funny. We kind of get these little rituals when we take pictures.
Yeah.
And the ritual now is look at the tiny little screen to see the picture I just took 2 seconds ago.
That's right, yeah. People are normally still sat in the same position where they took the photo.
The great thing about photos on digital cameras and all that, but the great thing about them is you'll just take more and more pictures than you ever used to with film. And
yeah.
I like that because you just load them up, and even if it's kind of a crappy picture, most people don't throw them away. They just keep them. Although I have got into the habit of, if it's a blurry picture, I just delete it out of iPhoto, because quite honestly, I've got a lot of photos in iPhoto. In fact, I'm kind of curious. Do you got iPhoto on the computer you're using right now?
Not on this one, but I know how many photos I have in my I use Lightroom, and I know how I probably have about 800-900 photos in my Lightroom library that is stuff that I've taken in the last 6 months or so, and then a whole load more that I've been archived away.
I've got Live in my iPhoto library, and I actually cleaned this out a couple years ago and moved a lot of photos over to DVD.
Yeah.
8,185 pictures.
Wow.
In 348 events.
Yeah. The thing is,
that's,
you know,
crazy.
When I used to go on holiday, I would maybe take two rolls of film with me. So
yep.
That was the 72 exposures.
Yep.
My last holiday, I took 550 exposures. I mean,
exactly.
I deleted a lot of them away, but, you know, nevertheless, you do take a lot more films. And just going back to what you're saying about Brooke, I mean, when we were growing up, you would not know for a couple of weeks if you were any good with a camera, because you would take a roll of film, and then you'd have to wait a week or so before you even saw the pictures back. So
yep.
It's very difficult to sort of improve based on what you've done, because who can remember what you did a week ago?
Exactly. Yes. But, you know, the thing is with digital cameras, they're so cheap now. The memory's so cheap. Almost everybody has a computer at this point. Everyone's nostalgic for yesterday. You know, you look at the pictures you just took yesterday, you import them and look at them. Wow, that's cool. But what's really cool for me is because we take so many pictures, you start forgetting about the pictures you took. And then you start, you know, letting your Mac cycle on screensaver, and it uses your photo library. And you start seeing pictures that you took, you know, 2-3 years ago that you only looked at once when you first took it. And you go, wow, I forgot all about that picture. That's a really great picture.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I, you know, photography has come a long ways. Probably it's made just as many leaps and bounds over the last decade as personal computers have.
Absolutely.
It's a fun subject. And I wish I was a better photographer, and I probably would be if I spent a lot of time at it. But most of my time is on video, not actual pictures. When you are on vacation, David, do you take pictures of what you're seeing, or do you take pictures of your family looking at the stuff that you're taking pictures of?
I like to do both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to have my family in take pictures of them in scenes, so that you know, and particularly, you know, take pictures of them. I like to have pictures of people enjoying themselves. So
yeah.
I will often pose people so we can have pictures and we can capture the mood of what we're up to. But by the same token, I'm also a big fan of taking pictures of what you're seeing so that you can share with other people, you know, what it is you experience on the vacation. And that, you know,
everybody wants to see the picture of the giraffe that you took and the five different shots of it.
Well, you know, the thing is that for every 5 or 10 pictures you take like that, you might get one or two, which actually is quite a striking image.
Exactly.
And provided you have the time and the patience to sit down and narrow those 500 shots you took down to maybe the 30 or 40 ones that really are good and tell a story, then actually I think that probably is interesting. I think where it's fallen down the past is people that, you know, want to show just the same, you know, they want to show every photo they took just in the same way as, you know, the rookie mistake with a video camera is to not edit the footage and just have everyone sit through 2.5 hours of jump cuts as they see every single thing you shot on your vacation. And
exactly.
that's no fun.
No, it's not. And the reason I ask is because a number of years ago now, one of the projects that we did for our family was to put a video together, and my Aunt Dar had a whole bunch of these photos and stuff. But the problem is the photos were of what they were looking at. And, you know, this was, you know, 35 years ago, 40 years ago. No one remembers seeing the giraffe. No one remembers seeing the fountain at Disney World. And no one cared to see them. But when they got to see themselves or their siblings, what they looked like back then, that's what people were really enjoying.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of my message to the people listening to the podcast. When you go on vacation or whatever you're doing, don't just take the pictures of whatever you're looking at. Because quite honestly, 20 years down the road, you're not going to care about, you know, 25 pictures of the caribou that you took on your African safari. You will care about what your 12-year-old daughter looked like at the time, or your 6-month-old son, or what you look like, or what your wife looked like. I've noticed that, and you probably run into the same problem, David, when you look through your photo library, how many pictures are actually you? Very few, I bet.
Yeah.
I bet most of them were your wife and your son.
Yeah, in our family, it's not so bad, because I use the digital SLR, and my wife has a handheld digital camera, and she will... If she sees me taking photos, she will take photos of me while I'm taking photos.
Yeah, so all your pictures of you holding a camera.
Well, yeah. I mean, she will have me put the camera down normally, but yeah. You know, she's quite good, and that way we kind of get a good coverage, and we try very hard not to take pictures of the same thing together. So at least, you know, I can bring her photos together with mine, and then we have a bit more of a rounded view. But I mean, if you've only got one camera in the family, then that is a real problem, particularly absolutely. If you're the camera guy. And yep. video is even more the case. Oh, absolutely. You know.
Well, the guy is always the videoist. I mean, the guy always has the video camera.
And so the only record of him on the vacation is the disembodied voice.
Yes,
directing
the camera.
People. Yeah.
Stand over there. Absolutely. Before we wrap this up, David, one last question. And I asked this because I actually had, these things run in spurts sometimes. It's really weird. I got two different emails from listeners this week.
Okay.
And that were similar. And they both asked, basically, what do you use to clean your notebook screen? And I thought, that's weird. We never talk about that on the show, and yet I get two emails within hours of each other, literally. I got them when I was in Utah, so yeah. Then it really stood out in my mind. What do you use to clean your laptop screen? And, of course, this could be for your flat panel computer as well.
Yeah, it's actually a very interesting question, because I'm one of these people. I can't stand to see smears or marks
yeah,
on the screen.
Yeah, I'm the same.
And
while
we
talk, I'm gonna clean the screen while you give your answer.
We are lucky with the modern Macs is that they're so bright that unless the screens are off, most of the time you can't see anything but the most heinous marks. But
yes,
I mean I'm looking at my MacBook Pro screen now, and I can see a couple which have obviously come from, you know, when I've had a sip of drink, and there's been a couple of drops have sort of flown out and touched on the screen there. What I tend to use for a matte screen, I might use. A cleaner. I use the iClear stuff
mm-hmm.
I like quite a lot. It's good because it will clean the screen, also clean the case.
Yes,
and it's good for that. Always with a very good quality microfiber cloth.
Yep.
Don't ever use anything made of paper.
Yes, don't use a paper towel.
Kitchen towels or anything are terrible.
Yes, they feel soft, but they're really not. They're very not, abrasive.
And they're really not very good, and really very bad. I mean, they're very absorbent, but they're really designed for soaking up things. They're not really designed for polishing at all.
No.
So yeah, soft microfiber cloth. The iClear I like, though it's quite expensive, I find. To be honest with you, the iClear's fine for matte screens. I find it really bad on the glossy screens that the MacBook has.
Oh, really?
You can now get the MacBook Pro, yeah. The problem is the glossy screens, because they're glossy, they show every single smear up.
Yes.
So unless you really, really clean it very well, you're going to see those smears, even when the screen is on. And so for a glossy screen, I actually tend to use another soft microfiber cloth, but I normally tend to use just a light spray of water on the cloth. Yeah, just very, very small
just
amount.
Just to make it very...
Just to give
very,
very slightly moist.
Yep.
Really just a very fine mist. If you can get one of those...
plant spray bottles type
exactly,
of thing.
Exactly, something
yes.
like that on a mist, on a very fine droplet mist, and just put a very small amount of
and
water.
And don't spray it directly on the screen. That's a lot of problems that people make. They spray the screen. Don't spray the screen, spray the cloth.
That's right. And if you get drops of water running down the screen, then you put too much on.
Yes, absolutely. So, and that's invariably that's going to find a little crease somewhere in your monitor screen that's going to get inside your computer, I guarantee
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah, so spray sort of mist over the cloth. Let the mist go onto your cloth, and then give the screen a wipe, and then just be quite gentle, but just kind of buff it up. That's normal.
Don't push on the screen. That's the other key. You don't have to use elbow grease to get your screen clean. I've seen I've got both problems right now, David. I've got the glossy screen on the iMac, but my side cart on this iMac is a 23-inch cinema display, but it's not glossy. It's the laptop type of screen. So I needed to find something that's going to do equally well on both, and I found this product called Clean Doctor, the Maximum Cleaning Solution, Ultra Clear, Streak-Free Screen Cleaning Solution. It was relatively cheap. This bottle is 8 fluid ounces. And it came with a very nice blue microfiber cloth, which is probably 12 by 12. In fact, I think it's exactly 12 by 12. And I bought it for $9.95 at the Office Depot. So if you've got an Office Depot or any store that carries a lot of office supplies, you're going to find this.
Yeah.
It works fabulous. I'm really impressed with it. And it will clean the Mac itself, the aluminum.
Yeah.
Or as you said, aluminium.
Aluminium.
That's I noticed that when I was...
Yeah.
That's how it's spelled.
That's how... Well, I think you spell it differently, but that's how the word was...
originally conceived, yeah.
Created by us, thank you very much. just one final tip on that. One other thing I do use... I mean, the cloths and liquids are fine if you really need to give the screen a good clean, but if you've got the occasional drop or smear or fingerprint or something like that, you know, particularly if the kids come in and point something at the screen and accidentally touch it, and you don't want to give the whole screen a good wipe, I've got a box that I got from Costco of... wipe and clear sunglasses wipes.
Yeah, kind that of does work.
Individual ones in a little packet, and provided they are rated for use on expensive sunglasses, then you know they're okay because they won't be too wet. They won't have any harsh chemicals in because the front of an expensive pair of polarized sunglasses is coated in much the same way that the screen laptop is. And so if it works for sunglasses, then it will probably be a good bet for your computer screen as well. And these things will normally say suitable for sunglasses, computer screens, and that sort of thing. And those are really great because the liquid they have in them will evaporate really quickly. So if you have just the odd finger smear, you can just get one of those out and deal with just the very small area that's smeared, and then after the liquid's evaporated off, it will be gone, and you'll be sorted. And that saves you having to give the whole screen a good going over.
Couple warnings: never, ever, ever use glass cleaner. Ever. Do not use glass cleaner. And the other thing is, if you don't clean your screen regularly, and you're looking at your screen as you're listening to this podcast, or you're going to look at it after you've listened to this podcast in your car driving home, and you look at it and you go, wow, it's been a couple months, don't just grab this clean doctor stuff and a nice soft chamois, microfiber. Don't just start cleaning it. You need to dust it first.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've looked at someone's computer and the screen is not necessarily dirty, it's just full of dust. And if you do our cleaning solutions on that much dust on the screen, David, you can hurt the screen.
All you're going to do is scrape that dust across the screen.
Yes, exactly, which is it's not good. I use, before I clean either the laptop screen or the iMac screens, what is this thing called? The Swiffer? The Swiffer picker upper thing?
Yeah, it's like a dusting type.
Yeah, it's blue and it's very soft. And I use that on the screen first. Get all the loose and the big particles up, then I clean my screen.
Yeah.
So I thought this was kind of important to share with our listeners how we clean our screen. And if you guys listening have a really good tip that we didn't mention, let us know and we'll share that with the listeners and maybe we'll adopt that too because, you know, you got to keep this stuff clean. And don't forget, and this is kind of important, a lot of people will clean the front of their screens often, but they forget to turn the machine around. And this is especially important if you've got like a Mac Pro or a G5 on the floor, a desktop machine. You need to clean the dust out of the ports.
That's right.
I use a little vacuum cleaner to suck the dust out, you know. And that's going to let your computer operate much more efficiently and a lot longer. Because I've seen machines fail because they've basically got 2 or 3 pounds of dirt and dust inside the machine and it just clogged it up.
And I think that's important for all the machines, even the laptops and the iMacs, because, you know, they
turn
all
it
have
around. Yep.
Yeah, they all have vent ports on the back, and you know that can get sucked inside the computer. And here's my final tip, and this one I think is
got one more after you,
right?
And then we'll wrap the show up.
My final one is if you're anything like me, your computers are in your space. It'll be your office or your den or whatever, and it's very tempting when whoever does the cleaning in your house, whether it be yourself or your good lady, or you have somebody come in and do that for you, or whatever, it's very tempting for them to say, you know what, my desk is covered in paperwork and pencils and discs and all the same things. So just don't bother doing in there. I'll deal with it. And then it never gets cleaned, and it can be like that for 6-7 months, and that's just letting the dust and the rubbish all build up, and it's just no good for your computer. So do yourself a favor. If your house is getting cleaned regularly, take the time in some period before it's going to be cleaned to actually just tidy your desk up so that whoever's doing it can come around and at least run the duster and the Hoover around there and get rid of all that excess dust.
Yep. My tip is a two-parter, and it has to do with cables. We always clean the computers. Very few of us actually clean the cables. There's this new sponge type of thing. It's called a magic eraser. Do you have those in the UK?
Yeah, I do. I swear by it.
If you haven't tried this, you guys are listening, and I know most of the people listening to this are guys. If you don't have the magic eraser, you're really missing out. I use this to clean up an old Mac, and it made it look, I'm talking one of the all-in-one beige boxes, made it look brand new, took marker off. It was just amazing. But what I started doing is using that to clean my cables, all my computer cables. Maybe once or twice every month and a half to 2 months, I'll unplug my cables. The magic sponge I get just barely damp, just enough, and I'll hold the magic sponge in one hand and run my wire, my cables, through it in my fist, and it cleans them up beautifully.
Yeah.
And as part of that, if you've got a port that you haven't used for a while, make sure it doesn't have a bunch of dust and crap in it before you plug something into it. You can really mess up your Mac doing that. Seriously. Yeah. If you've got a USB port that you haven't ever used and you get a new USB peripheral, whether it's a USB cam, a hard drive, whatever, don't just reach around and plug it in. Look at that port before you plug it in. If there's a bunch of crap in there, use a little can of some compressed air and blow the crap out of there first.
Yeah, absolutely. Just be cautious with that compressed air, because sometimes you can blow stuff into the computer if you're doing that. So, it's very
And that air will get very, very cold if you let it blow too long.
That's
as well.
Right. Yeah, the trick is to use it sparingly and often, and don't jam the button down and hope for the best.
Right, and don't stick the, because usually they come with the little red tubes.
Yeah.
Don't stick the tube in the port. You know, six inches to a foot away is just fine. The air coming out will be strong enough to dislodge any dust or any dirt or any grime that's in those ports.
Yeah.
But that's important. Maintenance on your computer, the physical maintenance, not just the hardware or not just the software type of maintenance that we're all used to hearing about on podcasts, the physical maintenance of your computer is often overlooked by even the most hardcore computer users. And I think it's kind of important, at least on this show, David, that we do talk about that occasionally.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm conscious. Something I noticed when I first got into Macs is you reading the forums about, you know, how Macs age and everything is an awful lot of logic boards get replaced on Macs. And historically I have done. And every time I read that, I wonder how many of those is from, you know, where the computer got all gunked up and the logic board overheated and burnt out, rather than actually being some sort of fault actually in the design of the motherboard itself.
Now, other than when we record this podcast, because I can get away with it, but I never smoke around my computers. Occasionally I do, and I am right now, actually, and I usually don't. But if you're a smoker, it's a really good idea not to smoke around your computers.
Yeah.
You really can damage it. Occasionally, like I do, is not that big of a deal. But if you're a chain smoker, don't sit in front of your computer. I've got an aunt and uncle who have the all-white iMac, the dead Mac you just got, David.
Bet it's not white
and
anymore.
It is the grimiest. It's almost beige.
Yeah.
And the magic sponge will commit suicide before it tries to clean that thing, because nothing will get the color off. Nothing. No. They had the lampshade iMac for a long time.
Yeah.
They smoked so much that the CD-ROM didn't work in it anymore. The lens was so clogged up.
Yeah.
With gunk that it just, you put a disc in it and it went, I don't think so. So if you're a smoker, don't smoke in front of your computer, says the guy who just put a cigarette out. So clean your Mac.
You're only an occasional offender.
I am. And I only do it when I record the podcast, and then not even all the time. But so that's our show this week. Clean your Mac. I think that's going to be the name of the show.
Excellent.
Clean your Mac. I even got it written down so I remember, David.
Great.
I don't think we've ever talked about that on the show, have we?
No, I don't think so.
I think I might have years ago with Chad Perry, but ever since you and Guy started with us, I don't remember ever talking about it. And it's one of those things that I think people need to hear occasionally, because we get forgetful. We really do. And I think anybody listening to this podcast, and I know you guys are listening right now, I guarantee you after listening to this, you're going to go home, you're going to turn that Mac around, and you're going to go, oh, crap, look at all that stuff. Man, Tim and Dave are absolutely, I need to clean this. This is disgusting. And your wife will be a lot happier.
Yeah.
Or your husband, if you're a woman. And here's another thing, David. Don't just clean your computer. Clean your wife's computer for her.
I'm looking at my wife's at the moment, but unfortunately, it's buried behind a pile of stuff on that desk.
Yeah, so I guarantee you pull that puppy out and look at the back of it, David. I bet it. My wife's Dell PC, which is infested by a virus right now, and I still haven't fixed it because I'm just not motivated to do so, was getting louder and louder and louder. It just seemed like that fan was running really loud. I finally pulled it out. It was so full of dust. I just blew the dust out of it, cleaned it up, plugged it back in, and it was virtually silent again. I couldn't believe it. Dirt in there.
If only removing the virus was that easy.
Oh, I tell you, it'd be fixed already. So that's our show. We'll be back next week, recording at our regular Wednesday night time, so you guys will get this on Thursday. Or, I'm sorry, no, our Thursday show, and you guys will get this on Friday. I don't think we've got any big plans for next week, do we? Other than my interview with Brian Head from... his new band is called Head, so Brian Welch from Head.
I think his nickname is Head as well, isn't it?
I think it is. Yeah, that's where it comes from. Yeah.
Well, I hope you do that because that's something to look forward to.
Well, one of the things I was supposed to interview the FileMaker guys. They agreed to come on the show this week, David, and I absolutely completely forgot, and I didn't contact them, so they're not on the show this week.
Okay.
Bad, Tim. Bad. So here's our hour and a half podcast. We're done. We're 2 episodes away from number 200. If you guys think of anything that you'd like us to do for our 200th show, send us an email, tim@mymac.com. Don't forget about the contest that we mentioned, 5 hours ago on this podcast. Posimotion. Yeah, send an email to news@appminute.com, appminute, appminute.com. And check out AppMinute. That's my other site. I do a lot of posting there. Spread the word for it. I need to get rich. Not really. Well, I do really need to get rich, but AppMinute's not going to do it. And hopefully within a week or two, I'll have some iPhone app news of my own.
Exciting stuff.
I tell you. All right, David, you have a good day.
And you.
Actually, it's a night time. What time is it there right now as we finish up recording?
It's 1 o'clock in the morning.
O'clock in the morning. You are our machine. You're my hero. We'll be back next week.
Speak to you then.
When they show a dog on TV, do you try to get your dog to look at him?
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.